This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
But it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome. You're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. It is Friday, January the 27th. We have much to talk about throughout the rest of the show. I'm Guy Johnson in London. Alex Steele, of course, is over in New York. It's been a bumpy week thus far. We've had plenty of corporate news that we've had to digest. We go into next week thinking, though, about what is happening with central banks. Bank of England, ECB and the Fed, of course, on deck next week. The market has plenty to think about. In terms of the price action today, FTSE 100 fairly flat at the close, 77.65. Year to date, we're now up by 4.21%. That is eclipsed by the DAX, of course, which is up by 8.81%. But what we've actually seen over the last couple of days is a NASDAQ that has come roaring back, Alex. And today it's up by another 0.7%.
Yeah, honestly, after Intel's terrible numbers, I would not have expected that to be the case. The SOX index is still lower, but it feels like the market finally wound up digesting the Intel news as an Intel-specific thing, and therefore tech gets a relief rally. I should point out that Tesla's also up something like 20% in 2 days, just putting
two
that
days,
out there.
2 days, yeah. It's up by more than 50% off its year lows, which is, considering it's only January the 27th, is pretty incredible.
Yeah, exactly. Overall, we also had some, I'll say, positive economic data here in the U.S. in prices easing, spending slowing, incomes a bit higher, the UMich numbers also coming in a bit better. So, like, all of that sort of helping the sentiment. I sound still skeptical because you know me, I am Debbie Downer.
We haven't used that enough.
No,
today.
But it's true. I know you're all the macro next week, but I'm all the tech earnings, and I feel like there is definitely a risk there. And you can make the argument that the reason why tech is having a nice run is because of Tesla. It's still 3% of the index, so it's still in some ways an idiosyncratic move.
Yep. No, if you strip out Tesla, it certainly doesn't look quite as clever. We'll come back. We'll talk more about what is happening this week, next week, in just a moment. Let's get the session set up, though. Here's Charlie Pellett.
Thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Here's what's going on. The UK is set to take in 250,000 more foreign nationals over the next 4 years than previously thought, providing a potential boost for the economy. Projections from the Office for National Statistics show officials now expect net migration to be higher between now and 2026, with the number settling at 245,000 a year thereafter, rather than the 205,000 estimated a year ago. Perella Weinberg Partners' London headquarters were searched this week as part of a German insider trading investigation. The investment bank was searched by officials on January 25th. Frankfurt prosecutors are looking into allegations that a London-based employee at the bank disclosed information on planned takeovers, and other suspects traded on that information, this according to sources. Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt says the government's flagship high-speed rail line will extend into central London, dismissing a report that it would end in the suburbs to cut costs. Hunt says he's not seen, quote, any conceivable circumstances in which it would not end up at Euston. Hunt's remarks to the BBC came after making a speech at Bloomberg's European headquarters in London. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie, thank you very much indeed. Charlie Pellett joining us. He didn't just talk to the BBC. Given the fact that he was here in our building, we felt it only necessary that we should also have a little bit of a conversation with the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And Jeremy Hunt was very firm. He was dismissing calls for tax cuts. He also pushed back against what everybody else seems to be getting very excited about, energy subsidies. He spoke to the one and only Anna Edwards.
At the moment, we don't have the headroom for major tax cuts, but if I was going to prioritise where I would like to see tax cuts, it would be business tax cuts that give us, as I said in the speech, even more competitive tax rates. It's important to say, Anna, we have the second lowest business taxes as a proportion of GDP amongst major countries. So the UK is already very competitive. But we want to do better.
The truth, though, in recent years is that investment has been lagging behind the G7 average, and not just the G7 average, but all members of the G7. So what can you do to try and close that gap? You've ruled out big tax cuts. So what are the levers that you would look to be pulling?
If we become the most productive as well as the most entrepreneurial country in Europe. I think we're already the most entrepreneurial, but this would make us the most productive. Then I think that will make a very compelling case for investment. And that's why I outlined the plan. I think we've got a very exciting vision. I think we have the opportunity with our universities, our financial services, and our technology strengths to be a Silicon Valley.
The US obviously worried about inflation there. They brought in their Inflation Reduction Act. Big subsidies in some shape or form for various industries there. You've said this morning that some elements of that policy worry you. Your colleague Grant Shapps described the policy as dangerous. What is it that worries the UK government about this policy?
Well, we think that if we're going to have the transition to net zero, we should benefit from free and open trade between all the countries that share that ambition, because that will mean we'll get there more quickly, more cost-effectively than if we go it alone. So we do have concerns, but we're also very optimistic that the UK will play a leading role in that clean energy transformation. We get 40% of our electricity from renewables. We are second largest in Europe, the largest when it comes to offshore wind.
Will we do our own subsidies, though?
Well, we will announce our plans. I have absolutely no doubt that we will be able to present a package that makes us highly competitive. But I don't think subsidy is necessarily the best way. I think what people want is creativity, innovation, ideas, a climate, a regulatory structure that encourages investment.
Jeremy Hunt, Chancellor of the Exchequer, speaking to Andrew Edwards a little bit earlier on today. Joining us now, UK economy reporter Philip Aldrich. I'm really struggling with what I heard then. There's nothing there. This was an empty speech. A lot of people have highlighted that was the E that we should have been talking about here. He has nothing. If I'm a businessman thinking of investing in the UK, what would I have heard as a result of what Jeremy Hunt said today?
There wasn't any policy that you can pin your hopes to. Basically, what the government is grappling with is the fact that we are struggling with the public finances. We've got this, we've still got this hangover from last year's sort of chaos during the Liz Truss premiership, and there really is no money left. The Office for Budget Responsibility has told the Treasury that they are going to lower the potential growth output for the UK. So he's talking about wanting to see a big increase in productivity. The OBR has just told him that it's effectively lowered our potential growth rate. He's just hearing lots of bad news, and all he can offer is, like, we're going to have stability, we're going to tackle the number one problem today, which is inflation, and we're laser focused on that. And government will eventually, he said, we want to be a party of low taxes, and when the economy comes under control, if we can offer spending restraint, he said that, then we'll cut taxes. So he says, believe in us rather than Labour, which never cuts taxes.
Don't companies want subsidies? I mean, the whole point of the reason why it's difficult for the energy transition is because a lot of these projects just don't make economic sense yet. Carbon capture, hydrogen, etc. You need the subsidies. Like, you absolutely need the subsidies.
Yeah, a lot of these early stage technologies do not. There's no commercial viability without the subsidies there.
Just felt like he ruled it out, and I don't know why.
Yeah, there is an interesting thing here where the UK talks a lot about its green, how much of a green success we have been, and we absolutely have been in terms of renewable energy. The amount of renewable energy as a share of the total grid is significantly higher here than in the US, and it's one of the we are a leading country on that front. But we don't make this stuff. We don't build the wind turbines. We import them and we install them. We do not have this large domestic green industry. So when we're talking about subsidies, there are potentially some subsidies coming through for the steel industry to help them decarbonize. So there'll be these targeted subsidies. There has been, there was the CFD scheme, the contract for difference scheme, which was what was a subsidy scheme for the wind industry, which started back in 2010. So we have provided subsidies, and there will be sort of targeted subsidies, but we don't have a large enough green industry to really hammer go big on big subsidies the way that the EU and the US are doing, because they are building, they've got much more manufacturing, bigger industrial, green industrial base than we have.
So what was today about? What was he trying to do today? Was this about lowering expectations rather than raising them?
Yeah, I think, you know, he's just had this bad news from the fiscal watchdog. March the 15th budget is coming along. Everybody is expecting a big corporation tax relief. You know, the businesses are calling for that. They're crying out for something because in April, our corporation tax is going from 19% to 25%. Mm-hmm. And the super deduction, which was this big investment relief, which has been in place for a couple of years, is going to be removed. And so you're going to have this huge increase in tax. It's £12 billion a year increase in tax on the business sector. So, you know, everyone is hoping for something. And what he said today was, you know, I haven't got any money, mate. I'm gonna. Yeah. If I had some, that would be the first thing I'd do. I would give you businesses some tax breaks so that we can drive this productivity thing. So, you know, I think he's saying kind of just jump in now, and when we get that bit of growth, you know, we're going to give you the tax cuts. But it felt like he was teeing us up for a budget which isn't going to be awfully encouraging.
Right, which is going to bum everybody out. And to your exact point, so you're going to see tax increases. There's also the windfall tax scenario on the big energy guys. So if there's not going to be the kind of subsidies or tax breaks, then it's going to be on the likes of like a Shell and BP that are going to have to spend a lot of money to help this energy transition happen. How do they do that if they are subject to windfall taxes and tax increases?
So this is where he kind of lurches back into this is the Brexit advantage that we have. These kind of the Brexit freedoms give us a chance to deregulate certain things, which make it easier to do business. But also, you know, we're changing rules in capital markets so that you can Solvency II rules so that you can get more capital invested into big infrastructure. So that's where he would say, the private sector is going to come to the rescue because we haven't got any money. The ABI has come up with this. The Association for British Insurers has come up with this number of £100 billion of potential capital that will be released as a result of these changes. Of course, he's saying this is Brexit freedoms. The Europeans are doing the same thing anyway, same sort of deregulatory stuff anyway. So it's not really a Brexit freedom, but you can pitch it as such. But that's where you haven't got the public money, so you know he's hoping we're going to leverage in a bit more of private capital to get this transition underway.
Isn't he setting himself up for a fall when he talks about the UK becoming a Silicon Valley?
Is there a time frame for that?
Well, no. In some ways, the UK already is. The problem is, though, that I think he's pitching it in the wrong way. The UK has a huge life sciences advantage. The UK does do certain things very, very well, but that already exists. So I'm wondering what the language he's using here and what he's expecting to come from it.
So the example which the government has trotted out quite a few times now is that we are only the third country which has a $1 trillion tech industry. The Chinese and the Americans, US have got that, but we have as well. So we are, you know, he's got grounds to say that we could be a Silicon Valley. We certainly have got, you know, our skills in science. We've you know, DeepMind, massive AI company, yep, which has grown here. So there are you could definitely point to a sort of ecosystem which definitely supports that kind of tech boom. The problem we've always had in the UK is that we go from startup to scale up to, you know, to unicorn,
for the whole, basically.
And then it's sold, basically. So yep. Then what happens? You speak to people, and it's do the VC guys just want to cash in when they get their 10x, or do we have a cultural problem in the UK where you just don't want to become as prominent, mm-hmm, as Bill Gates or as Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk or anything? So that's why we don't really kind of create a Silicon Valley. Something stops us from holding on to the big companies. They get eaten up by Google or someone.
So I could also make the argument, bear with me here, that like there is enough of the pie to go around. Like the energy transition is going to be big enough that like there's going to be room for all the main players to play. So if that's the case, is there a first mover advantage that the UK is losing out on, or like is everything going to be okay just in like a couple years?
On the subsidy stuff?
Just in general, in terms of attracting the capital, attracting the talent, attracting the companies.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if we don't attract the talent, then that's going to show up a few years.
But meaning, like, do they have to do that right now?
I think with the, I think the way they're playing it with the energy transition is that they they believe that if you get these huge technological advances, we can do some sort of groundwork on research and development and develop some new technologies here, but then others like in America can just roll it out on an industrial scale, and we can basically get the benefits of the massive capital investment mm-hmm. that they spend on green industries over there back here, which is effectively what's been happening with Danish wind farm developers basically yep. giving us their expertise and us just installing it. So you can imagine us just thinking that that's the way around we'll go. We don't need to move first, and we certainly haven't got the deep pockets that the US and the European Union has.
Yeah, that was made very, very clear today. Really mm-hmm. useful and interesting analysis. Philip, it's been a fascinating day in some ways. Just to give us an idea of the kind of reality of the situation here in the UK. Bloomberg's Philip Aldrich, thank you very much. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. Let's get to Visa. I understand it's a U.S. company, but it has footprints everywhere and has a great cross-border read. So the stock is up by 2.6%. Results beat estimates. Price targets were lifted by a lot of analysts. And a big part of what helped them was cross-border travel that really supported them. And the question really becomes, can that continue if jobs market has to roll over, if the unemployment rate has to go up? We're seeing lots of different companies lay off workers worldwide. So we were able to sit down with the CFO, Vasant Prabhu, about this. And we talked about where the strengths are, where the weaknesses are.
Cross-border business, as you know, has been in recovery ever since borders started opening. And we've seen quite a bit of recovery so far, but there's more to come. It's been very strong in Europe, in and out. Our Europe cross-border business is well above 2019 levels. Latin America has been strong for a very long time. It stayed open through most of the pandemic, and it was a favored destination because it was open with few restrictions. The Middle East and Africa benefited from the FIFA World Cup and in general has also stayed fairly open. Where we've had things still recovering is obviously Asia. Asia was late to open. Our Asian business is still below 2019 levels, both in and out. Most of Asia is now open except China. Japan just opened. It was up almost 50 points soon after opening. And China is just beginning to open. The other area that is not quite back to 2019 levels is inbound travel to the US. And that, we think, is because the dollar was quite strong. As the dollar has weakened a bit, we've seen that pick up. So the room for recovery left in the business, and there is still recovery left, is in Asia, in and out, into the US, and we await the travel from China. China has opened, but it's going to take some time before the travel picks up. Airline capacity yep. has to be built up, ticket prices, visas, and so on. So all in all, some more to come, but a lot has already happened.
Vasant, as you highlighted, good morning, it's Guy. As you highlighted, a lot of the pickup you've seen in Europe has been driven by Americans using that strong dollar to travel and enjoy European attractions. As that reverses, is this a zero-sum game? As the dollar loses ground and Europeans start to go over to the United States, do you lose out the same amount of Americans going to Europe? Does one cancel the other out?
Well, we think there's a ton of pent-up demand, and you've probably heard that from the airlines. In fact, there's more demand than there's airline capacity in some cases on some of these routes. And yes, Europe has been a big beneficiary, not just from U.S. travel, but we've seen travel from other parts of the world go to Europe, perhaps because the U.S. was also, expensive. Yes, there will be some shifts, but we think the demand is so high and there's so much pent-up demand from many years of people postponing travel mm-hmm. that at least for the foreseeable future, we don't think it's a zero-sum game. We are anticipating the cross-border business continuing to recover through this year. It's still got some room to recover before it gets back to what you might call the pre-COVID trend line.
Yeah.
So we do think there's room for all of it.
So, Vasant, to that point, we're getting a lot of layoffs in different sectors. It was tech, banks, now industrials, now we get Hasbro today, et cetera. And I know this is a U.S.-focused question, but do you still feel that pent-up demand can continue if we keep getting layoffs, if the hard data that starts to roll over? What's your visibility?
Well, you know, we've been very clear that we are not economic forecasters. We've stayed out of the economic forecasting business. We'll leave that to the economists. And nor is our business a leading indicator, because we see spending as it happens. You know, I don't know if you don't feel good about the future and will not spend something 2 weeks from now. I only know when you do it. So I want to be careful to say the consumer has been very resilient all year. In the U.S., consumer spending is up 45-46% over 2019, which is a pre-COVID trend line. And that's been true the entire year in 2022. And it hasn't changed yet. That's what we can speak to. As to what might happen, you know, we'll leave that to others. You know, we can tell you that the consumer remains remarkably stable in their spending at this point.
Yep. You're in San Francisco. As Alex says, tech is laying people off. What about you guys? Do you feel any need at this point in time to protect the middle of the P&L, to protect the margin story? Are you confident that you have the right setup right now? Is there the opportunity to hire more as others lay off? How are you thinking about your staffing needs?
Well, we've been fairly, very disciplined, I'd like to say, through the pandemic. We didn't get carried away. You know, we've had a steady increase in investment in our business. You know, ours is a long cycle business. You have to invest today if you want revenues in the future. You know, we didn't go overboard. You know, we didn't overhire. Hopefully, you know, our headcount is up, our investments are up, but not, and we've started to moderate that. I don't expect us to cut back in terms of having layoffs. We'll wait and see what the recession is like, if there is one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what we might do is moderate the level of spending, which we're already doing. And we've also planned some changes we would make in the level of investment in our business. We will continue to invest, but we might moderate it. We might postpone some things. We might decide to deprioritize some things. I doubt we would have any layoffs. Mm-hmm. What we might do is, you know, moderate the rate of increase.
Okay, so you have some levers on that to pull. At the same time, U.S. banks are trying to really increase their exposure to Zelle's parent company. Talk to me about how you retain market share in that environment. Are you worried you're going to be losing some customers there?
Well, we'll keep doing what we've always done, which is deliver the most frictionless experience when it comes to paying digitally, make it very secure, very reliable, offer a variety of services around it where you can get your money back, make the security and fraud levels as low as we can make them. And as long as we can do that, you know, we think we become the preferred method that people use. We have a brand people trust. We've been around a very long time. People have come to believe that we never let them down, whether it's reliability or security or fraud or dispute resolution. And that's how you win this game. You win it on the merits. You win it on the capabilities you offer. You win it on being a superior service.
That was Vasant Prabhu, CFO and chairman of Visa, vice chairman, I should say, of Visa. Okay, we're going to continue the conversation with earnings and also the economic data that we got today and how it places the Fed in a pretty good position going into next week. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, this is The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. All right, checking here on U.S. markets. S&P is up 0.3%. The Nasdaq up 0.8%. A big part of that's Tesla, which is up basically 20% in just 2 days after earnings. You also have Amex, the outperformer, after a really solid 2023 outlook. I do want to point out, just because it's me, Chevron stock is off 5%. This is a big move for a company that just announced a $75 billion buyback. Yes, their profits were disappointing, even though they still made a ton of money. And a big part of that is downstream. And they said some really interesting things on the call about having to like dig a little deeper to get oil out of the Permian, and that what they had already done is a little bit dried up. And that, I think, is really interesting when it comes to the overall oil and production landscape. How much more oil is really out there? Are we going to talk about peak oil again? That would be really fun. Okay, that's my two cents here. Guys trying not to breathe deep and sigh. Oh, ha ha. The amount of times I hear about jet engines. All right, let's get Charlie Pellett here.
All right, thank you very much, Alex Steele. Here's what's going on. Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt is dismissing calls for tax cuts and pushing back against green energy subsidies, warning that, quote, sound money must come first, as he argued that Brexit will drive U.K. economic growth. And in an interview with Bloomberg Television, Hunt said, quote, at the moment, we don't have the headroom for major cuts. He was speaking at Bloomberg's European headquarters in London, where he made it clear that fiscal constraints will make it hard to find space for business tax cuts to boost investment in the upcoming budget on March 15th. Superdry shares, super big losses today, plunging 17% after the fashion retailer cut its profit outlook for the year, blaming its underperforming wholesale business and warning of potential consumer weakness in the months ahead. The British retailer is known for its logo t-shirts and bright colors. Norway is maintaining its right to cut power exports, but only if there's a real shortage of electricity at home. The government today presented its highly anticipated plan to control exports during a supply crisis. Germany and the Netherlands rely on electricity from the Nordic nation, which is sometimes referred to as Europe's green battery because of its vast and cheap hydro resources. And by the way, about 10% of the UK's electricity demand is also met by Norway. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
All right, Charlie, thank you so much. So the other big news of the day, we're all waiting for the core PC. It was going to be super exciting. It wasn't terribly exciting, but it was interesting. Can both those things be true? Personal income up by 0.2%, so still growing. Personal spending down 0.2%. Saving rate moves its way higher. The PCE core deflator, which is what the Fed looks at, core month-on-month is up 0.3%, year-on-year 4.4%. That is lower on a year-on-year basis from the month before. So these feel like relatively good signs. In the UMich, the final read for January, you had longer-term inflation expectations lower and one-year inflation expectations lower. Let's make sense of all of this. Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent, joins us now. Your read on the data dump.
You're making me sit up here. I was sitting in Charlie Pellett's chair accidentally here, and the back goes way back. I was
going
does
it?
Yeah.
Well, he just really chills.
Yeah.
It starting with this, does this mean that the data was actually really boring? You don't want to talk about it? That's okay.
The data wasn't exciting, and that is exactly kind of what the Fed wants to see. They want to see the economy slowing. They want to see inflation coming down, and basically that's what we got. Personal incomes, the headline number, as you mentioned, was up by 0.2%, but the big news was in the wages and salaries part, because it grew only 0.3%, and November grew only 0.3%. November and prior months had been in the 5 to 6 tenths range. So it does show that some of the wage pressures the Fed has been worrying about in terms of inflation may be starting to slow. Now, the personal spending stuff wasn't as good a news, because what we saw in the fourth quarter was strong spending in October, but then a drop in spending in both November and December. And then we saw the savings rate go up in October, November, and December. So maybe Americans were pulling back and a little concerned about what might be happening with the economy. Of course, a lot of news about the possibility of recession and the Fed raising rates and all. So the question now becomes, do they continue with that?
Is this America talking itself into a recession?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question that I have put to people before. Back when George W. Bush came to office and we were going through the dot-com bubble burst, he came to office immediately wanting to do stimulus and saying, we're going into recession, well, we did. Now, did we talk ourselves into it? That's an interesting question. Can you do that? The good news today, Guy, is that we got the Michigan numbers, the expectations numbers, the overall numbers suggested that Americans feel better about their situation. I mean, it's not great yet, but the direction is changed and are feeling better. So maybe if we can get through the next couple of months without disaster, then people will feel.
To that point, though, and you made this on TV, let's use me as a test case, and literally as a test case, I'm saving, I'm not spending. Legit. So if all of a sudden I wind up feeling better in the next few months, do I start spending again? And that's going to lead to, say, more inflationary pressures. Like, in a weird way, does me saving more mean something bad?
Can I just caveat this as well? Is spending less saving more?
Well,
For me, it is. I swear.
There's an old logical theory about tragedy of the commons. Everything that makes sense for an individual doesn't necessarily make sense for society as a whole. No. So it makes a lot of sense for Alex to stop spending.
Thank you.
But
I can't believe she agreed with you, but anyway.
Is it good for America that Alex stops spending and everybody else, too? No, I mean, it would not be good if everybody cut back at once and stopped spending. And that looks, to a certain extent, like what happened in November and December. Now, was part of that because people were having trouble with inflation? And, of course, back in November, we were still seeing gas prices really high. So as inflation comes down, do people feel better about the economy as we get into 2023? Is it the kind of turnover, new leaf, new year situation? And are people going to feel better? And then if they start spending again, I don't think we're in a position to have blowout spending again.
Yep.
People could go back to spending, but the cash cushions that people had from their stimulus checks have been worked down quite a bit. And we also saw the savings rate rise, but not to a high level. It's, you know, it's just...
Hey, man, it takes a while, she says defensively.
if you keep going with that. But if people still, you know, if people... Yeah. Don't save much more.
It requires grit to do that, though, doesn't it? It requires real kind of perseverance and determination.
Yeah, well, we know who has that. So,
I really don't. We're going to see how long I make it. Hey, it's been a month. I'm going to celebrate
It is January the 27th.
Yes.
You do not understand
the sales that are happening right now.
So
it's been 4 weeks.
People are selling stuff that people don't want.
I absolutely want the things. So, these last 4 weeks is really like 12 weeks, if you look at it from like a sales perspective.
This is Alex's version of dry January.
It's so true.
No, it is. It is. Yeah. Go drink your way through it.
It's 100% right. That means that the first, I'm going to go cry.
Well, the President of the United States would like you to start spending again at some point. So it's your patriotic duty.
It's your patriotic duty.
Yeah.
Don't encourage her.
It's true. He's like tempting me. He's looking at me like, haha, you can do this. Mike, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Bloomberg's Michael McKee joining us there. Okay, coming up, let's talk more oil. Are you excited, Guy? Can I get you excited about Chevron?
Yes,
can I make it happen?
I like that having to dig deeper, I think, is interesting.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You listen to Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson over in London. Just to make Guy's day, we're going to talk more about oil and hope he doesn't fall asleep. So Chevron, shares are up by as much as 5%. We haven't seen this kind of slide since September of 2022. Profit disappointed, had a huge buyback. But Guy, it's some of the commentary that I want to get to. So they're talking about the Permians, for example, and they say they do have plans for deeper Permian drilling. This is according to the CFO. In addition to that, they also say they want to re-optimize Permian development plans. We don't know what that means. And that they see lower growth in the Permian due to DUC exhaustion and rig moves. DUC exhaustion is the drilled but uncompleted wells. So you do some of the hard work, but you wait to finish it off and pump the oil. That's exhausted now. I find that to be really interesting.
Just explain
commentary.
That. So that means that they can't do that anymore.
Yeah. So there were a lot of wells that were drilled but not finished over the last few years, particularly during the pandemic. And a lot of what they were able to do, all oil producers were able to do recently to step up supply, was to finish them. That's done now. So there is none of that inventory.
America has become like Saudi Arabia as a result of fracking. And mm-hmm. The Permian is at the center of that narrative. Have we gone past peak Permian?
Yeah, you know, genuinely, I don't think we know yet. So the first thing to know, you never, ever count the wildcatters out because they have come back time and time again. So they will find new ways of doing stuff. However, if you have the good acres, you've probably done a lot of the drilling that you can do. And there's already so many different ways that you can get oil out of the ground. How many more ways can you find? Like, we've done it where you have super long wells down and then super long pipes out, so horizontal. We've done that. Okay, the farther you went, so you created some problems, so you couldn't do it anymore. You can, but just not as far as you might have thought. We're already pumping other stuff into the ground to get more oil out. How many more things can you pump in to get it out? I wonder what, quote, re-optimizing is and what that actually looks like.
If these guys, their valuation is based on the Permian. Like Chevron, probably more so than any other company. Well, more so than any of the other kind of big companies. If they've got a problem, the stock's trading at 178, and oil prices are probably going to go higher. So you would assume some upside on that. But it's based on the kind of the Permian. I've yet to hear people talking about the Permian being an exhausted story.
Yeah.
This is kind of the first time I'm beginning to hear this. If that's the case, that's huge.
But let's not forget, we don't want to oversell that point because, like I said, there's a lot of innovation that has still been out there. I would make the argument that with Chevron, they do have a lot of other assets, particularly when it comes to LNG. Exxon's similar thing. Exxon's thing is going to be off the coast of Brazil in Guyana. That's going to be their big deep water bet. And
but that's expensive. Deep water is expensive, risky, tricky, troublesome. The whole idea of the Permian was that it was fairly straightforward.
Yes, true. But the international and the deep water, that's where the money's going. If you go through any of the oil services companies' calls, that's where all the money is flowing into.
Is oil cheaper on the stock market than in the ground?
Is oil cheaper on the... I have no idea.
What are we not talking about? Can you go out and buy a company more cheaply than drilling for it? I.e., can you buy somebody else's reserves more cheaply than you can go out and find new ones?
We were kind of talking about that with Paul Sankey of Sankey Research. He's been covering oil companies sarcastically for many, 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 many years. And I asked him about that. And his idea for Chevron was a bit different because they have legacy leases in the Permian where they don't pay anything for the land. So anything that they buy would be a little dilutive. But yes, the answer is yes. At some point, they're going to have to. Some outsized calls are why don't you go buy some of the oil majors in Europe that have diversified in a much different way? I just don't know if value, why would you do that? Why would you go and buy BP if BP is going into wind and solar and batteries? Why would you do that?
An oil company, I think is the point you're making.
Yeah, but how do you not overpay for that at this moment is the problem. They're super disciplined, Chevron is, about how to pay for stuff.
Such an interesting area, honestly.
Really? Are you messing with me?
Of course I am.
We're going to hear a lot about planes next week. Let me just tell you.
Very exciting. Very exciting.
This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. Intel is down. Intel is currently down by around 8%. It fell 10% at the open. That was the biggest move for the stock that we've seen since July. This after what one analyst described as an astonishingly bad set of results. Actually, it was the forecast. It was the forward-looking statement. It was the outlook that caused the most consternation after Intel revealed its numbers. And the stock has been punished, I think is one way of putting it. Where are we in the Intel journey? Remember, this is a business that is going through something of a shift, of a change in terms of what it does and where it does it. Mandeep Singh covers the stock for us at Bloomberg Intelligence and joins us now. Mandeep, is this a reasonable reaction to what Intel has told us?
Absolutely. I think whenever you see such a big gross margin degradation, Intel already had a lot of issues going on with regards to the chips that they were making and the demand for those chips. But the fact that gross margin outlook is 39% when last year it was 60%, clearly there is something wrong with the business. And we know Intel has very high fixed costs because that's what it takes to manufacture your chips. Even TSMC has very high fixed costs. The difference is TSMC has a lot of demand when it comes to the chips that they are making, whereas Intel... it's an incumbent player when it comes to the PCs and the server chips, but the market is sort of moving away from them, and I think that is something that needed to be addressed. But obviously, it's a multi-year journey, as Pat described it when he took the helm.
Is this good news for other chip guys?
I think there are puts and takes here. One, I do think PCs are almost the earliest in terms of, you know, kind of looking at a downside sort of scenario for the chip makers. And there is a reason for that. I mean, it's dependent on refresh cycle. And what you're seeing is PC refresh cycle was pulled forward after the pandemic. And now you're seeing a bloated inventory situation. What could happen down the line is the same thing could happen for servers and data centers. And we know, you know, hyperscalers have been very aggressively spending on building data centers. In fact, Microsoft said they are still increasing their CapEx for next year. So that demand is still resilient, the server chip demand, and same thing we've seen on the auto side. But there will be a time, I do think, you know, that we will have excess capacity across the board in different industries. Mm-hmm. And I think PCs are probably leading that. And so I do think second half you will see some sort of a negative revision for companies that are more exposed to auto chips or, you know, even servers and data center chips.
Intel obviously has been a major feature of the landscape this week when it comes to the corporate reporting season. What are you looking for next week?
Well, so next week we have all the digital ad companies, Meta, Alphabet, Snapchat, their reporting results. And Apple, I mean, I mentioned about autos and data centers. Well, we've seen a similar volume decline on the handset side as well. And if Intel's earnings were bad, guess what? Apple, I think, are going to be pretty negative in terms of the volume side. They may make up on the content because their Pro phone is obviously a higher-priced phone, so the ASPs may hold up. But you will see similar volume decline. And on the digital ad side, look, we've seen a significant ad pricing compression when it comes to the digital ad companies because of the slowdown in economy, and the first thing to cut was ad spend. Now, what you want to see, given there has been de-risking of the estimates for all these companies, is a stabilization in ad pricing. If that happens, I think it's good because, you know, the stocks will anticipate a second-half rebound. But if there is more ad pricing compression, that's where I think it's hard to predict when that bottom will be. For these companies.
Amazingly, Meta is off the lows that we saw back in November. I fail to see
quite a lot off the lows.
Yeah, but you just look at the chart over the last year and like where it was in the beginning of February. It still looks really painful, and I just wonder sort of where the good news might be for this. That's a nice way of me asking it. Where's the good news going to be?
Well, so good news could be adoption of Reels and time spent on Reels versus TikTok. They're trying to narrow that gap in terms of engagement, and for all the social media names, ultimately, it's all driven by engagement. If they are able to keep the engagement, ad spending will follow. And so for Meta, it's all about Reels catching up to TikTok. WhatsApp could be a bright spot. They've been focused on monetizing. They've started to give some numbers around the click-to-ad messaging run rate, and that actually has been a bright spot. So I think those are the two things to call out for Meta.
Mandeep, is Meta basically just a play on TikTok being banned or heavily restricted in the United States?
That will be a near-term catalyst for sure, Guy. But at the same time, I think Meta has like a lot going on with its VR investments, and the fact that they are losing almost $12 billion on Reality Labs. When you have a company like Roblox, which is, I think, the closest competitor to what Meta is trying to do on the Reality Lab side, and they are not losing as much as Meta is. So it makes you wonder, what are they spending on, and how long can investors bear that sort of investment coming from a company of the scale of Meta?
Quick question, just to circle back to Intel before we let you go. Intel, dividend at risk?
I don't think so. I mean, it really has to be a catastrophic second half for me to think they're going to cut the dividend. So, I look, at the end of the day, PCs are cyclical. I do expect a rebound once the inventory clears out. And if they catch up on the process nodes, they have a lot of levers to cut costs before they have to cut dividends. So, I do think they're going to, like, they already extended the life cycle of their equipment. That's going to save them on depreciation costs. They're doing more cost cutting. So all that has to happen before a dividend is cut.
All right. Mandeep.
Good stuff, Mandeep. Thank you very much. That wraps things up for Alex and for me. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Wait, but more importantly, I will see you guy in person in the studio next week.
That's very exciting.
This is going to be very exciting. I don't know if he's going to stay awake for it, but it'll be exciting.
Boeing is delivering its last ever 747, commercial 747 next week. Quite excited about that. We'll talk about that next week. This is Bloomberg.